Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What say you, Richard Ellett Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them, okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
Have to see Paul and Maggie during the night times when you're attempting to go to sleep. I'm sure they come and visit you. Sure.
All day and every night.
Yeah, I'm sure. And they will continue to do so and reflect on the last time they looked you in the eyes, as you looked the jury in the eyes.
Welcome to Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdochs Murders, Money and Mystery. I'm Ann Emerson. I'm here with our exclusive legal analyst, Charlie Condon, also South Carolina's former attorney general, our executive producer, Drew Tripp, as well as Max Harrison, our chief photojournalist for WCIV, our composer of our music, and the person who is running this entire production right now, as well as helping us field questions on this very last day of our time here in Walterboro, but certainly not the end of this story. I think there's still so much more for us to unravel as Alec Murdoch, the defendant, in this double murder trial of his wife and son, is now headed to state prison. The sentencing came up today, like all of the other incredible days that we've had over the last 6 weeks. It did not lose its momentum whatsoever. It just was a crescendo. We came to incredible symmetry in this story, in this case, in this trial, in these lives that have been affected. Charlie, it was an incredible thing to watch, wasn't it?
Yes. Judge Newman. Judge Newman fan club, just everyone needs to join this because I've never seen anything like it in a court proceeding where he, in the process of sentencing someone to double consecutive life sentences. And by the way, in South Carolina, that means your entire natural life. No parole, day for day, you die in prison. That's the sentence. And in that process, he had some of the most eloquent words and meaningful words that I've ever heard uttered in a court of law in South Carolina. And I'm not going to attempt to paraphrase or take anything that he said and try and put up my words, because his words in the setting, I mean, he's there sentencing somebody that he's been there for 6 weeks like we have, but he also had a previous relationship with this defendant, and he also knew quite well. I mean, Judge Newman, he was the deputy prosecutor, deputy solicitor. I served in Berkeley County across the river there, the Santee River. He was in a county called Williamsburg, his hometown of Kingstree. So he would have known through that service to the state at that time of the Murdochs in the 14th Circuit. And then he would have, as he talked about, he had this relationship with Alec Murdoch over the years. And all that was brought to a head where he went through, wow, just listen to it. I think we would not do well to paraphrase it, because everything, we could maybe hit highlights of it, but the way he capsulized spoke about what was happening in this courtroom here in Walterboro, South Carolina on this day, it was whoa, it just took your breath away. Once he finished, I didn't know what to say. How about you, Drew? I was left speechless.
You could tell it was personal for him. This wasn't just sentencing a person, just some Joe citizen. It was personal, and he made it personal. Mm-hmm. He was having a one-on-one conversation with Alec Murdoch.
Yeah, and it was a back and forth with the defendant, too, to a degree.
It was a conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I thought it was stunning. There were times I was speechless, to your point. Yes, absolutely. And some of his language, I used the phrase earlier today, medieval. He was tearing Alec Murdoch apart up there, bit by bit, and he was taking his pound of flesh, and making it clear how he had let down his family legacy, how he had just utterly ruined his own reputation and perhaps permanently damaged his family's reputation. But that the legal community, mm-hmm. the justice system in the state of South Carolina, it was. Again, stunning. He torched him. He and yet there, Alec sat in the face of this, what I think would be for most people unbearable criticism and scrutiny, and was unmoved. I didn't do it.
Yeah, I love them. I loved them. That's what he just said. I love Maggie and Paul. I'd never do anything.
Never hurt
to
them.
Hurt them. And you know, there was. There was one expression he used that Alec had said in his testimony, which I think sort of took your breath away, the way he was able to turn it in this part of the sentencing, which was so powerful, when he talked about the tangled web we weave. Yes. That was something that Alec Murdoch had basically mm-hmm. expressed, right, on
he
the
did.
Stand.
He did.
And he said, what did you say? What was that expression? And just kind of giving mm-hmm. it a beat. And Griffin goes, he said, what a tangled web we weave. Mm-hmm. So it was extraordinary to see the defense get sort of layered into that. Oh,
and then
he says, you know, about the tangled web, you were such a gregarious person. And then that web you spun into
right.
was so unfortunate. You had such a lovely family.
Yeah.
He really chastised him and let him know what he was leaving behind, the life that he had lost. It was all left. Your license to practice law was stopped.
Mm-hmm.
You made your final appeal as a lawyer. You waived this right. And I tell you again, I respect this. Would never... under any circumstance. Oh, he said, I give you this opportunity to speak right now. And he said, I respect this court. Alec Murdoch said, I respect this court, but I would never under any circumstances hurt Maggie and Paul. So after multiple opportunities that Judge Newman gave him, he still chose not to express guilt.
Yes, and I was also very much moved.
Oh,
he's going to be a side.
I would never, under any circumstances, hurt my wife Maggie, and I would never, under any circumstances, hurt my son Paul. Paul.
Well, and it might not have been you. It might have been the monster you become when you take 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 opioid pills. Maybe you become another person. I've seen that before. The person standing before me was not the person who committed the crime, though it's the same individual. we'll leave that at that.
Well, he certainly did. He certainly did. And that he was, that Judge Newman was able to bring this around, and he wasn't letting Alec Murdoch off the hook, in my opinion.
Oh,
he
yeah, was not, just not
what, you know what I mean? He wasn't excusing it. He was just saying,
well, yeah, and I took real note too when he went into, you and your family had access, you were the, in effect, the law in this part of South Carolina, you had access to the wheels of justice, and you and your family would have been, I think he said this very courtroom, mm-hmm. you would have sought the death penalty for cases in which the conduct was less egregious than what you committed. He didn't fault the Attorney General for not seeking the death penalty, but he made a point that I certainly understand what he was saying. And it was so powerful. And it was just one powerful thought, one meaningful thought after the other. What was it, 10 minutes?
At least. Yeah, I didn't actually. I would have to look back at my notes right now, but it was at least 10 minutes that he spoke. And, you know, I think that when we heard the fact that not only, you know, and he reminded us, you know, Newman reminded us, like, that he did have to take the portrait down of Solicitor Murdoch,
right, Buster,
who had been up there. And it reminded me, too, when he was talking about this, about a conversation that you and I had back in October, maybe September of 2021, when I came to talk to you for the first time about this case. You said very eloquently, Charlie Condon, Charlie said to me, if you were up against the death penalty in the 14th Circuit, there was a good chance that you could be prosecuted and sent to death row, that the chances of you getting the death penalty were high, is what I think
he
said.
Yeah, there were. I mean,
and that was because of Buster Murdoch.
Yeah, he was known for his trial skills. And, you know, I was the junior young solicitor there in Charleston, Berkeley, and he was the senior circuit solicitor. I think at the time he might have been the oldest one. He certainly was the longest serving, if not one of the longest serving, and he was known as a master of prosecutorial skills. And so here we fast forward, doesn't seem that long ago, but I guess it is, but what, 20, 30, 40, 50, and now his grandson has been convicted of double homicide in the Colleton County Courthouse. Need I say more? It's just unbelievable.
Jay?
I've got a few things, but I want to start with some confirmation. I don't know that this is breaking news per se, but we knew this was happening, but I just received confirmation that Alec Murdoch has been transferred out of custody from the Colleton County Sheriff's Office to the State Department of Corrections.
Wow.
That has happened. So he is in state prison now, or on his way to state prison as of right now.
Yeah.
He's no longer in the Colleton County Detention Center.
Yeah.
Backing up, because I want to talk more about the death penalty, backing up to two things real quickly on Judge Newman. An analogy that came to me today, and I've used this in other times, the way Judge Newman was speaking to Alec was not impassioned. It wasn't loud. It wasn't boisterous. It wasn't yelling. It was measured, and it was very even told it. Not that he ever, the only time he raised his voice in that trial that I recall was when he told Jim Griffin to sit down.
That's right. That was it. When Jim
when he kept objecting.
Yeah.
It's for those who've played sports, you'll have your coaches who are very animated and yell and shout, and they might be shouting praise, but you also have the coaches who shout criticisms and chastise you, and they're loud and they're boisterous, and they embarrass you in front of your peers and the stadium and whoever else is looking when they're yelling at you. And then you have those coaches that get right here in your face, and they whisper it to you. And that was always, to me, the more impactful. You yell at me, in front of a bunch of people.
You're strained to listen. I strained to listen to Judge Newman today.
You yell at me in front of a bunch of people and try and embarrass me. I'm going to fight back. You want to make a scene? I'll make a scene. But when you get right here with me, and you're telling me about myself, whispering in my ear exactly what I've done wrong, and you're making it intimate, that was always the way. Okay, that's how you light the fire. That's how you get the motivation out of me. And it's not a perfect analogy. I understand this is not sports we're talking about, but I'm talking about human nature and the effectiveness of language and communication and how we communicate with one another.
Right.
And I just thought it was so striking.
Yeah.
The way Judge Newman chose to handle that.
And I'd be curious on your thoughts on this. You know, you saw the defendant maintain his innocence, even though Judge Newman said there was overwhelming proof. But I noticed in the defense counsel's press conference, there was the same theme of the family, the Murdoch family came to court for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. They wanted to hear the evidence. And the defense counsel said that they weren't convinced of Alex's guilt. So there does seem to be a bit of a, when you say an unusual theme within the Murdoch defense team, family, and the defendant himself, that I think is highly unusual, because they would have, I mean, I would have thought at the very least, well, there were 12 citizens that heard the evidence. Mm-hmm. And are you saying that they're wrong and don't get what has gone on? You would have thought there would have been some deference, that there might have been some reconsideration of our position. Let me absorb this. Let me think. But he was very strident, didn't you think, that they don't believe that the case was proven? And I was really struck by that, because I just heard the defendant say the same thing. And then on behalf of the, I think he was speaking for the entire family, correct?
Right.
That they don't believe the case was proven.
And to that point, I want to get back to the death penalty. But that is a good segue into what I wanted to bring up. And I was speaking with Nick Bogleboros. He's the New York Times reporter who's been here in Walterboro since the trial began, covering the trial. We were talking about the death penalty today and why the state didn't pursue the death penalty. And I made this same comment to, Jay Bender. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Lost my train of thought for a moment. Jay Bender, who's been one of the media liaisons, court media liaison for throughout the trial, very respected press freedom attorney here in South Carolina, always looking out for your journalists, making sure we can do our jobs without interference from the government.
Well, now that I've gone over to the other side, I can now sing his praises, but I remember when I was attorney general, I was less than like he was a little bit of a thorn in the side. So it's funny how the rules change.
Yes. So with Nick and with Jay.
Life is long.
Yeah.
With Nick and Jay today, Judge Newman's comments being what they were about the death penalty not being pursued, and to your point, Charlie, about the defense still feels like the case wasn't proven, but are you saying these jurors didn't hear what we all heard? And the way it worked is you go back to day one, and I've said this, I had to be coaxed along with all this in this trial, given my opinion and my analysis each day. I had to be brought along. It's like, show me the full picture. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, you can't deny how extraordinary and almost unthinkable the state's position was. It's a thousand mile high view of a giant picture all narrowed down into a sharp focused focal point of this all led to murder. Oh, and by the way, it was for no more consequential reason than just for his own self-preservation and being able to kick the can down the road. What an extraordinary thing to believe. And every domino had to fall along the way. Mm-hmm. If you look back, they had to get in the motive evidence with the financial crimes, with the drugs, with the roadside shooting. Every domino had to fall for them to make this stick and to make it work. And they didn't know they were going to get that. The state prosecutors didn't know if that was going to happen for them. So I think that might explain why we didn't get the pursuit of the death penalty. We should have asked about that when we had the chance today with Alan and Creighton.
Yeah.
And we'll get to them more in just a few minutes. We did get the chance to interview Alan Waters and Creighton Wilson. Oh my gosh.
I like that.
I flip-flopped them. Alan Wilson and Creighton Waters, excuse me. But just Charlie, what are your thoughts on that with the death penalty, and what has to happen to go in to go after a death penalty trial?
Can I just break in for just one more second?
Sure. Please.
I just got a confirmation from Christy Shane at the SCDC at the Department of Corrections that he has now arrived at Kirkland.
Wow. Awesome. He's good there. To know.
He's now.
So please carry on. Yeah. But I wanted to make sure that everybody watching this heard what I just told you.
Yeah, he's gonna.
He is in state prison.
He's gonna be in a bad spot there, having been in that exact facility. What he's gonna go through, reception evaluation. It's not a pleasant process. Anyhow.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable.
Death penalty, South Carolina. I believe I can really speak to this because I've been involved in many, many cases with the death penalty sought. And from experience, this is how it works. You do have the same standard of proof for murder case, capital case. When you think about it, actually for a speeding ticket, when you go to magistrate's court, it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. However, and I can speak to this from personal experience, once you tell jurors that the trial's split up. You have the guilt phase. If he's found guilty of murder, then you proceed to the penalty phase, life or death, and you have a day in between of waiting to cool the passions of the jury. If you tell jurors that you're, as part of this process, we are going to ask you to consider, if he's found guilty, whether you put this person to death or not, the standard of proof changes, not legally, but practically, from beyond a reasonable doubt to no doubt whatsoever. Mm-hmm. We know definitely did it because there were eyewitnesses, there were confessions, there's all sorts of physical evidence that ties them to the murder. Absolutely no doubt the person did it. And unless you have that level of extreme proof, I do think the possibility, probably the likelihood of a hung jury just goes up exponentially. So I do think they were wise not to seek it in this case, because I do think it would have resulted in best case scenario for the state for a hung jury. But having said that, when you do look at his conduct, which they have now proven, mm-hmm. it's definitely death penalty warranted as a possible mm-hmm. punishment. So that's the conundrum you get into, or the paradox of the whole system. As a practical matter, you really couldn't get a death sentence. But from a moral standpoint,
right.
If somebody else is getting the death penalty for X conduct, you look at Alec Murdoch's conduct, it's going to be right there with really the worst of them.
Mm-hmm. Just had a thought, and we can move on. Charlie, what came to me as you were saying, the point you were making about the death penalty and why it's such a leap for people, there's no coming back. You make a mistake, you get the wrong guy, and I'm not saying that's what happened here. You get the wrong guy in a life sentence
that's
case.
Right.
That's through right. appeal, through right. further investigation, right. it can be overturned.
That's right.
If he sentenced to death, there's no coming back. Mm-hmm. No coming back, and what he's leaving behind. And you said that a few minutes ago. The Judge Newman was making the points about what he's leaving behind. What we know from this case, you know who's not coming back? Maggie and Paul. Mm-hmm. But you know what he's not leaving behind? And Judge Newman made this point. You know what Alec Murdoch is not leaving behind in all this? Their memories. They're going to visit him
I know.
In the nighttime.
How he came up with that. I
every
really must say,
night
that,
and day.
That really struck me as just such a powerful comment.
Well, I think he's been haunted in that courtroom to some degree. I mean, forgive me, Judge Newman. Maybe you haven't been haunted in that courtroom.
No, but anybody who sits in there has got to be haunted. Don't you have like sort of nightmares about this, or just unpleasant thoughts as you think about what he did?
I mean, I can't get those last moments, and maybe it's because we had such extraordinary deliveries by our lawyers and our legal teams. We had some of the best of the best, I would argue, in this country, because Southern lawyers know how to talk, but they they knew how to bring it home on both sides, and they turned that script around. We heard how Maggie was running toward her baby as he was gunned down by Alec Murdoch. That was the state's take, but of course the defense's take was, well, what if he was running towards, you know, mm-hmm. Paul, running towards his baby, mm-hmm. the defendant, when he saw him when he got home from Alameda. And it doesn't matter which way you cut it, that will take you apart, especially if you're a parent. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, they did their job. They haunted us, and they will for a while probably. Mm-hmm. You know, another thing that Newman said before we move on, I wanted to say, you know, we had a lot of lawyers in this because this was a lawyer that was in trouble. But Mark Tinsley came up and I thought it was just so extraordinary. He said, to have a tiger like Mark Tinsley on his tail to pursue justice for Mallory Beach. And we got a chance to hear from Philip Beach. Mallory's father was there to see the sentencing with her mother. Mm-hmm. Mallory Beach, of course, was the one who died in that fatal boat crash where mm-hmm. they say Paul was driving drunk. Mm-hmm. Which precipitated, according to the state, so many of his actions, mm-hmm. Was that his desperation mm-hmm. because he was losing everything.
Yeah, Judge Newman didn't leave him off the hook on that, did
but
he?
A tiger like Mike
Yeah, and
Mark
he also
Tinsley.
Referenced the confrontation with the chief financial officer of the law firm, doesn't he? And so he wasn't letting the defendant off the hook on, like, hey, you say you testified you're having a normal family day. And he wouldn't
right.
let off the hook. I'm not believing that. This is what was going on. To have a judge articulate so well the concerns one would have about a defendant's character and actions in that setting that he did and still respect his rights. Because he said, this is called the right of allocution. You don't have to speak. I'm going to give you this right. And you're not choosing to do it. And he led him down the path of wouldn't let him off the hook. If you're not going to speak now, fine. But here's what I understand you to be doing, in effect, which is continuing this life of lies, right? About what he said.
Yeah.
And it was just something.
That's
when
exactly
it,
right.
When does it end?
Where does it end? So we also, yes, we were in that courtroom. I don't know if I'll ever be able to get all of my thoughts condensed. And I know that Drew Tripp is working on just a fabulous wrap-up mm-hmm. package right now. I know that we are working on how do we get to tell the story to you even more as mm-hmm. we go through. But we did get to talk to people as they were leaving the courtroom, witnesses, people involved, you know, on the defense and the prosecution and just a host of people who had come to watch Emma, just speaking to people that had watched this whole thing and the journalists. One of the star witnesses for the prosecution was also available to us. Thank you to Charlie Condon. Had spotted Dr. Ken Kinsey, the deputy chief over at Orangeburg Sheriff's, but he was also a star witness for the prosecution for sure, because he had, first of an all shucks kind of a good old boy like Orangeburg. You know, he was like, I'm right up the road from you guys here in Walterboro, and I can talk to you about what I saw as I investigated this crime scene. But I couldn't help but ask him this question. I wanted to know, where does he think the guns are in this? Because that has really bugged me. Here's what he said.
Well, I don't know. I believe there were some missed opportunities, but I also believe at that point in time, I don't think the state could have taken it any further, being all those characteristics that we've talked about. I don't know that it could have went any further at that time. And, you know, they were awful critical of some of the things that the investigators for SLED did, but there's never a perfect investigation, never a perfect crime scene. And my hats are off to them. I think they did one heck of a job. And if it was me there as the victim, I want them coming and I want them doing it the same way.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. So to recap that a little bit, he voiced, I think, a lot of the concerns that I've had Mm-hmm. But he voiced them through the eyes of a law enforcement officer, which I'm not. There were missed opportunities by the state law enforcement division and their crime scene investigators, their forensic investigators. Yes, we've plowed that ground. Not to beat that horse any further. No horse left unbeaten, right? Dick Harpootlian. But to that point, he also gave the insight. I don't think he says that he didn't think that they could have actually taken it any further. And I don't know. I don't know that I'm in any place to criticize that as far as where the investigation was, the scope of the warrants they had, the information they had at this point, because as we know, information was being withheld. Mm-hmm. Very critical information was being withheld. And he didn't exactly let sled off the hook, but he also tried to rationalize it from the perspective of someone in law enforcement for the layperson, the person who's not informed. That's his take. That's his opinion. So it was good to hear that other side of it. I will note that I had questions that I wanted to ask SLED today. We did get a SLED press conference, but SLED Chief Mark Keel just made, he's very media averse isn't maybe not the right word. He's just not very public. He's not one of those agency heads who's out in front of the cameras all the time. Anyway, we did see the rare press conference from SLED Chief Mark Keel, and he gave statements. He did not take questions. I had questions. One of my questions that I was eager to ask him is, and I wanted to frame it this way, is we heard so much from the defense about during this trial about the failures of SLED and what they didn't do and what they should have done. And you have to take that into context of it being, you know, the defense is trying to tell you a story and they're trying to sell you a narrative and they're trying to make the facts look as good as they possibly can be in favor of their client, the defendant. But at the same time, you have to take them with a grain of salt. You also have to take them with their credibility. So, were there actual legitimate criticisms coming from the state that SLED is going to take to heart and act on? And have there been after action meetings where they come and review what happened and how they did things? And, in the future, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And hey, we're going to go to the state and we're going to ask for more money so that we can have this equipment. Mm-hmm. By the way, tried to put that ball in Dick Harpootlian's court today when he
that's a great question you asked, and I think that was a wonderful question you asked at his press conference. And to paraphrase, you asked Senator Harpootlian, who's a state senator, mm-hmm. in your role as a state senator, in light of your professed concerns about the state law enforcement divisions and what they didn't do in this case, are you going to do something as a state senator? And great question. And as I understood his answer, he said he wasn't going to mix the two roles. So
right.
Answer would be no, nothing.
Yeah, he punted. I threw him a hot potato, and he juggled it and threw it right back at me.
I thought about that. I said, it really sort of makes sense in a way, because I do think if he jumped into the state Senate having experience as a criminal defense attorney, that could be a bit of a conflict of interest.
Yes.
But I do also think it was a fair question you asked him. So, and let's hope that I would expect that Chief Keel, I've known him for many, many years. I have to think that they will internally look at what happened in this case and make improvements. I would have to think that.
And as a resident of the state of South Carolina, as a taxpayer, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. as someone who counts on that agency being there if I ever need them, that's what I want to hear. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's any solace to the family of Alec Murdoch, who feels an injustice was done here, or if it's solace to Maggie Brandstetter's family, mm-hmm. The Brandstetter mm-hmm. family on the other side, mm-hmm. and all the victims who feel.
Right. Which, by the way, was interesting. Didn't you think that, as I understood it, they didn't appear in court today at sentencing, mm-hmm. any of her blood family?
Yeah.
Maggie Murdoch's family. And on top of that, as I understood it, under our procedure, you're allowed to fill out what's called a victim impact statement. and had the victim advocate read it or present it to court, and I thought I heard Crate Waters say that that wasn't available. So I'm assuming that something to that effect. But it was no, there was no public statement relative to Maggie Murdoch's family's, of course, you know, typically they speak on behalf of the victim who is dead. And that, you know, that didn't occur in court, did it? There was no one there voicing her other than this, which I think he did quite well, Creighton Waters. He voiced it quite eloquently and well. But typically in a murder case, you have a long period of time in which the loved ones of the deceased speak passionately about the harm done by the defendant. And that wasn't done here. I don't think it affected sentencing because the conduct was so egregious, but that wasn't there, which I thought was kind of interesting. Now, again, I may be mistaken, there wasn't a victim impact statement, but I would have thought if there were one, it would have been produced by the victim advocate. So there you have it. That didn't happen.
And just trying to reason through that, what else is there left to say? What mm-hmm. is there to say? That
mm-hmm. I'm assuming the lifelong relationship that's going to go forward with Buster may have had a huge impact. And what?
Fair
enough. I do think from a legal, practical standpoint, I do think that, you hate to say a foregone conclusion, but mm-hmm. I would get close to saying that consecutive life sentences were going to be imposed in light of the conduct. I mean, it's just top shelf. We talked about death penalty eligible. That whole, I mean, which is what he did. It's just so unthinkable that the maximum sentences allowed by law should be imposed, and they were.
Yeah. We've just gotten some new information, and I have, while these two gentlemen were speaking, I was bringing in Alec Murdoch's new mugshot has just arrived from Kirkland Correctional Institution. I'm sure we will be able to get it up for
wow.
you shortly. But I wanted to make sure that we were getting this out because we are still in our newscast as we are going to air right now. So I had to make sure that we were getting as well our podcasts, all of our live streams, as well as information out there for all of us right now. It is an extraordinary picture. We will certainly try and share it with you as soon as possible. But his head is shaven again, and he looks like he is going into the R&E. Charlie, you were about to talk about that. Can you tell me
yeah,
a little bit about
it's
what that
South
looks
Carolina,
like?
46 counties. So pretrial, your county responsibility, county pays for it. I think Greenville County actually has an exception to that where they become after, and short-term prisoners under a year are county responsible. I think in Greenville, after, I want to say 90 days, they become state prisoners. But regardless, pretrial, he's now a state prisoner. And typically, and I think it's appropriate that this happened, but typically the, you know, term of court, general sessions, they sort of send the bus up to R&E, I think after a couple of days or maybe the next week. But they made a point of getting him out of here, which I think is wise. He's a state prisoner. It's reception and evaluation. Having been in there on behalf of a client, I now understand why they do it. But this client, he was, of course, I wouldn't speak about any details of this, but just what I witness is I think that really the purpose there is to depersonalize
right.
someone.
Oof.
And so they march in a line. There's no television. That's an understatement. No literature. I do think they did allow sort of a Bible here or there. And the cells that I witness, typically I saw two-person cells with the toilet facility right there with no privacy.
Mm.
And so they evaluate you as to a violent crime he's been convicted of. There are certain prisons in which violent criminals are sent. Now, having said that, and you know him as well, Brian Sterling is our head of the Department of Corrections. I do think that it would be appropriate, without giving him special treatment, but to be concerned about his safety. And that may
Absolutely.
Result in him being somewhere different than the normal inmate would otherwise go, because I do think that the likelihood of him being harmed seriously in a state prison, if you didn't take that into consideration, is high. And I just think that is something that should be considered, and he's an expert at that. He'll know how to handle that, and whether or not it means a different prison, I don't know. Maybe they could do it safely within the typical prison he would go to. But our state prisons, I will tell you this, and as a criminal defense lawyer here in South Carolina, you want your client to go to the federal prison. if given the choice versus the state prison, if the sentences are otherwise equal in time. We just don't have nice prisons. That's an understatement.
I totally agree. And I think, I totally agree. Listen, one of the big stories that I worked on for years was after the Lee riots. After the Lee riots, we were, Director Sterling was, I thought, very open about the work he was trying to do in order to get cell phones, contraband cell phones that were getting into his prison. He put the blame squarely on those cell phones, that was what was causing all of the problems that led into the riots that happened at Lee. That was one of the worst riots we've ever had in the United States, and killed, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but it was several prisoners. To go into places like that and really see what these state prisons look like, it's hard to describe. Honestly, for me, it was an experience that was not just a visual experience. It was an auditory experience. It was all of my senses were involved. When you go in, all of your senses are involved.
Right. Smells.
The smell. I will never forget what it smells like in these prisons. And I don't mean that in a crass way at all. Mm-hmm. I mean that in an institutional way.
Right. That's right.
It's very much an institutional feel. And it is remarkable how that stays with you. And it's an oppressive smell.
I'll say, every time I visit a facility on behalf of a client, I'm always worried when those doors close behind me. I am getting out, right? I mean, I just can't stand to be in there for more than a couple of hours, because it's just not, I don't know how to describe it other than you've got cramped quarters and you have all these people that just are around you that, and then you do get the sense, how can I put this politely, there are a lot of like not nice people in there.
Sure.
And I just think he's gone from, I'm assuming he was treated fairly well within our county prison system. And of course he up till now hasn't served any jail time. He's not used to it, as some people might otherwise be, who would have committed such horrible acts. Sometimes, they lead a life of crime, and then this is sort of the final chapter. This isn't the case here. No prior record. And boom, he's right in there. And so he's got this, I think it's 30 to 45 days where he's evaluated. And I think the shock on him, his experience here for the next day or two is going to be extreme.
Right.
And I'm sure they're going to take measures, too, also. I don't know if he's thinking of harming himself. But the whole, there needs to be an addressing of both the safety concerns and that issue, because for those that want him punished, and I do think that's a very appropriate emotion and thought, particularly to not only to deter him specifically, but to deter others, and I certainly would share that sentiment, that is occurring.
Yeah. It is, and it is shocking. It is hard to believe how far this man's fallen, and to know what he's going to have to deal with now is unbelievable. I want to get to a couple of bites to get back on what we were dealing with today. At the end of today, I had an opportunity, along with Drew and Charlie. You were with us as well. We had an opportunity to speak with Creighton Waters and Alan Wilson, the Attorney General, and his prosecutor, Creighton Waters, the lead prosecutor on this case, as you all well know at this point. And they sat down in our chairs at our tent and had a few minutes to answer a couple of questions for us. I'd like you to hear, I think we're going to play Waters first. Is that right, Max? Let's hear what Creighton Waters had to say first.
I think we always thought that he would take the stand, and that was a different type of cross-examination than you normally do. I wanted to get him talking. I wanted to give him the opportunities to keep talking. I felt confident with those pauses that he couldn't help himself. I felt confident that eventually the jury would see him, as convincing as he was on direct, that they would see him, wheels turning, and lie to them to their face and get to experience that themselves. And I think that ultimately, that was a seminal moment in this trial as well.
To the question, this is my last statement, but to the question that I've been asked and you probably thought about and Creighton addressed it earlier, to the question is, what would drive a man to murder his wife and son? And especially the defense said he loved them. I've never doubted that in his own way he loved them, in his own warped way he loved them, but he loved himself more. And murdering his wife and his son was the price he was willing to pay to preserve his way of life and to preserve his own personal legacy. And that is why I'm so grateful that this jury found him guilty and that Judge Newman gave him consecutive life sentences.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Wow. You know, what a team, first of all. You know, the entire prosecution team, you know them well, probably better than anyone else, I'll be honest. And the only reason I can say that is because right before we sat down in the chairs and I'd heard a little bit about Creighton Waters and how he knows Charlie, but I wasn't aware of Alan Wilson's role in your office. Tell us something.
Oh yeah,
about
I mean,
that.
It's what a moment for me, right? Because I hired Creighton as an assistant attorney general in 1998, and then Alan had served as an intern in my office. So that did kind of remind me, particularly with Alan, is really be careful with the people you might have a little authority over, because as you come down the ladder, they may be going up the ladder. So a little life lesson for others that might be out there to keep that in mind. And the whole trial was each one moment after the other. Of course, I ran against Dick for attorney general back in 1994. So, but anyhow, it was just great to have him on set. You did just a terrific job, you and Drew, of asking them questions, and I'll let y'all get into their answers, which I thought were really insightful answers from the prosecution team, who did just a great job, along with everyone else that was here in Walterboro, South Carolina.
Well, I have to say, I'm going to let Drew go. The thing is, you work on a case for this long as a journalist, and you are just, your curiosity is beyond. It's like all of a sudden you're allowed to look at the puzzle answers that are upside down, mm-hmm. that you've been wanting to read, mm-hmm. from the crossword or the puzzles, you know,
right.
Like what's the riddle? What's the answer to the riddle? Well, you have to turn the paper upside down to see it. It's like Waters and Wilson turned the paper upside down for me today. And it was so, so nice to finally at least hear what they thought. Obviously we still have so many questions in this case, but at least we got a glimpse into how they perceived it.
Yeah. And for me, my question to Creighton was, what was the bingo, the aha moment? What was the light bulb going mm-hmm. off for the state, for the prosecution, for the investigators? Was there a day? Were they all sitting in a room together? Were somebody reviewing records and then they come like some scene out of a movie where they come running down the hall? I got it. I figured it out. No. They pieced it all together, according to Creighton Waters, they pieced it all together like we did. Mm-hmm. It required that 1,000-mile-high view, that way you can't, mm-hmm. if it ended in the very narrow focus that we got, the pinhole sharp focus that we got at the end of the trial, what happened, when it happened, how it happened, who did it. The why and piecing it all together wasn't that simple, and it came step by step, and Creighton explained that also to me, and in my head I wanted it almost to be that, just that storybook ending of that there being some unsung hero on the prosecution team, or Creighton himself sitting there late at night with a drink and got his finger on his temple, and he's thinking and it clicks. It wasn't like that. This was old-fashioned work. They worked, mm-hmm. and they worked and they worked and they put that puzzle together piece by piece. And then July 2022 rolls around and they've got it. And it took them over a year, but it worked. They got there.
They got there. And it's such an extraordinary opportunity they gave us to like peel back that curtain.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And, yeah, they were very open, weren't they?
They
like
were
that.
Open. And I mean, is that normal to, I mean, nothing's normal about this case.
I think not really, actually. I think there's been so much attention on this case, I think they feel, and I think it's wise, they feel free to discuss strategy and what they think because of the many questions people have. And so if you don't give people information, sometimes people think the worst of mm-hmm. you. And I think that one question we had, did SLED purposely do a bad investigation in order to help the defendant? So I think it's good they're peeping. I agree with you. It's too bad Chief Keel doesn't feel comfortable with the Q&A because that would have been good to have some answers. I'm not criticizing. That's his style. But I'm glad they're talking about it. And the as I said, the interest in this case is at a really high level, as it should be. I'm super interested in it just because of the background of it. And also, I should reiterate this. We've talked about this before. This is really unusual for the Attorney General's office to be prosecuting a murder case to begin mm-hmm. with. The typical murder case in South Carolina is prosecuted by the circuit solicitor, unless there's a recusal.
But he recused himself.
You're right. And so, but what I'm saying, the recusals, I hate to put it this way, but the recusal on juicy murder cases, and I hate to use any word that's positive here with a murder case, but you catch my drift on
right.
like a murder case that has this sort of information in a background, circuit solicitor's not going to be sent that to Columbia. They're going to prosecute themselves. But it was a wise recusal. Solicitor Stone had to recuse himself, so it went to Columbia, which is really, really unusual. Typically, the ones that you would get, and I can speak to this, are the cases that have legal, factual issues that are messy. You don't particularly want to get them. They're just these conflict cases. You're going to be involved with something that has possibly, and not that this didn't have all those elements, but it's usually not the pick of the litter, so to speak, in prosecution cases. But this was unusual. So you had this high-profile case sent to Columbia. They could have sent it to another circuit solicitor. I don't know if they investigated that or not, but they've kept it. And so you typically don't have these line prosecutors within the office itself. And I think I know they didn't hire John Metters for this case, but it is very fortuitous. You had a really experienced murder prosecutor within this case team. I just think that he was essential, not to denigrate anyone else. Creighton did a great job. Alan Wilson did a great job on his direct examination, Dr. Kinsey. But I do think that the spark, I thought, came from John Metters. I don't know what y'all think, but I think he was a really valuable member of the team.
I mean, he spoke so well to those jurors, and I'm sure that when we speak to the jurors, they're going to be able to elaborate on that as well. He made it, and this is what we talked about last night, in a lot of ways, Metters made it safe for them to go ahead with what they felt they needed to do. He gave them the license by saying, you've done your job here. You've done it. And, I just felt like he gave them, it's okay. We need to put the bad guys away.
He really did.
And we need to protect.
Yeah.
We need to protect this from ever happening again. That's what Judge Newman did today.
Exactly.
By saying, he said the same thing.
Exactly. And pardon the personal, just a personal note. I mean, to see Creighton Waters, who I hired, Alan Wilson, and then John Metters. We can go through the list. I'm going to leave somebody out. Don Zelenka, who I've worked with. I mean, to see that whole prosecution team bring home the bacon, so to speak, to win this case against a veteran, well-funded criminal defense team, I couldn't be more proud. And I think it really speaks volumes of the South Carolina legal system in a really positive way. There's a lot of negativity in this case within our legal system. This is a shining moment for our state's legal system. And I couldn't be more proud of the state's team and Judge Newman.
Charlie, did anybody, through your connections, anybody over there at the Attorney General's office listening to this podcast that you know of?
To answer that question very directly, but off, without giving names, yes. And so, and also what has been, I've been touched by this, the number of court personnel.
Mm-hmm.
And those that are in that courthouse that do listen to it. And so shout out to all those folks. Did a terrific job. And talk about this for a moment. I mean, the clerk of court staff, the sheriff's office, the city of Walterboro, the Walterboro Police mm-hmm. Department. I mean, it just has been just, I kept thinking there was going to be some big glitch or something would go wrong. It has been flawless.
Yes.
And I even said to Captain Chapman, who also was on the stand, because he was one of the first responders to the mm-hmm. to the murder trial. He was also one of our neighbors with the Colleton County Sheriff's Office mm-hmm. special ops truck, mm-hmm. you know, van, mm-hmm. was next to our tent where we did all of our live shots for this. Honestly, what a lovely group of officers. I can only say thank you so much for keeping us safe. If y'all remember, halfway through this trial, we had a bomb threat. And that was scary. We had it was scary for me because I knew I had just spoken to a group of about 20 students who had come into the courtroom to watch the proceedings. So I knew that half of our courtroom was filled with kids from high school and college, and that just was way too close for comfort for me. Mm-hmm. So that's what concerned me. Of course, this was a bomb threat scare. Mm-hmm. There was never a bomb. Mm-hmm. But I talked to Chapman about that today and said, thank you again, because the way you handled it was very cool, mm-hmm. as it did with Newman. Newman just said, everybody clear the courthouse, as he would. But I, you know, just thinking back on moments like that, it was in a high profile double murder trial. You have a bomb threat in the middle. And these officers came in and clocked it and dealt with it and got us back on track. We were back in court.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was well done.
And felt safe. Mm-hmm. I felt safe.
Very safe. Really well done.
My question about the prosecution team listening to the podcast was about the fact that we've several times now heard our statements what we've said here on the podcast, just talking it out amongst ourselves. We'll hear it later on, maybe not verbatim, but we were on the right track. And we had in that soundbite that Max played earlier from Creighton Waters, he was talking about, I just let Alec Murdoch talk. And we picked up on that very night of what he was doing. And you remarked on Charlie how it was so it was against the grain, like against the book. That's not what you do. You ask.
It's well remembered. Yeah.
And
yes or no.
But yes, Alec could not help himself. He could not stand the silence, the empty silence. Creighton knew it and played into it. We found that out today.
Yes. And Creighton Waters is just brilliant in this case. And, you know, I didn't have time to really watch the pundits on national television, but I did pick up a little bit of it's just awful. He's asking these open-ended not yes. I thought to myself, I don't want to call them foolish, right? Because that's stooping to a level I don't want to go. But I thought, you really have not been at this trial, seen how this developed. Mm-hmm. And every one of those why questions, none of them hurt the state. And there was so much fodder to help convict Alec Murdoch and that method that I just thought it was just genius as I watched this unfold, so much so that I think that rule, so to speak, needs to have a Creighton Waters subset on that, with the exception of C. Creighton Waters, because it works brilliantly.
C. Creighton Waters. I want to also, you know, Metters, just going back to Metters for a second, I've got a clip I want to play. John Metters wanted to leave the lights on Waters and Wilson, but I have to say, I think we're going to have to give the last word to John Metters. We're going to come back. Actually, we're going to have the last word.
To Bubba, right?
I do want to say from the prosecution team, mm-hmm. as Metters was walking out, I of course door stopped him, as I would as a journalist, with my phone out. And so I caught him as he was coming out, so he mm-hmm. doesn't get in trouble with anybody on the team here. And he said, "No, I'm gonna defer." But he said one last thing, and I want you to hear it.
Are you allowed to speak to
him? Supposed to go through the office. I'm just pleased with the verdict. It was a tragic, sad case, and God bless Bubba.
Did you catch
wow.
that?
Wow.
God bless Bubba.
Bubba, and the way he said it with that gentlemanly, nice southern accent, it's music to my ears. And
well, someone, help me. Tell our listeners who Bubba is, if they have forgotten.
Yeah, if you've somehow not heard the name Bubba
Bubba's
yet.
A pretty popular country southern name, so you got to
actually had a human Bubba Hightower testify, remember?
Yeah.
So this is not that Bubba.
The dog that was out and had chased down the chicken, the Murdoch's dog, Maggie's dog, Bubba, the rambunctious, hard-headed yellow lab. And but for that dog, Alec Murdoch calling out to him, we don't have the definitive evidence that he was lying in his alibi. And yeah, that was a point that John Metters made in his rebuttal and final argument for the state yesterday, which was thank God for Bubba. Mm-hmm. He testified and he got Murdoch to just say something, just a passing word in the background on a video, and it turned this whole case around for the state.
And it was something that they couldn't get their hands on for 9 months, but it goes back to that Paul was directing this from the grave, that whether or not you believe in any kind of afterlife, no matter where you come from or you gotta see what just happened. And that is, at some point, Paul's phone was unlocked. I got teenagers, so I know they do all sorts of crazy things with their phone, but it was like his birthday code or something. Yeah, ended up unlocking it. It's something that simple.
Yes.
And they got into his phone 9 months later and found this video, and it let the world know possibly, you know, really what happened. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's extraordinary. You can't write this stuff.
No.
And I sat with some of the most unbelievable writers throughout this whole thing. And I've gotten to work with some of the most amazing journalists.
Same here. And
legal minds. I don't know if anybody, I mean, you should see how many people have come up, honestly, to get to meet Charlie during this. And it really speaks to what a legacy you've had here in South Carolina.
Well, I appreciate that. It's been rewarding to be with you and Drew. And we've also had, in the middle of a murder trial, how could you have the fun moments we've had as well? You know which one I'm talking about in particular. So, yes, you got a question?
Throw your phone.
We're good? All righty.
One thing I wanted to add, and you mentioned this a minute ago about the city of Walterboro, the Colleton County Clerk of Courts Office, Colleton County Government, the Colleton County Sheriff's Office. Listen, I'm from here. I'm born and raised Colleton County, South Carolina. Walterboro was my home for most of my life. And coming into this, there's a little Chamber of Commerce city phrase here, city marketing phrase here that they use, brag about Walterboro. And I'm going to brag about Walterboro for just a minute, because I was so, so worried coming into this about the perception and the criticisms of a bunch of, for lack of better words, uppity, bougie, city-fied folks who would just come in here and look down their noses and have all kind of criticisms and say this and that about this little country town. It's not a country town. Walterboro's, I mean, thousands of people live here, but it is not Charleston. It is not Somerville. It's not the big metro areas that it would get compared to. It's a stop along I-95, and it's sad to say, it has become somewhat of a bedroom community for those bigger areas that I just mentioned, the Beauforts, the Charlestons, the Somerville, the Orangeburgs. People live here and they drive to work. The average census data shows the average drive commute for work here is 30 minutes.
Wow.
And that's because you're going a long way to find work. This is not an economically rich place. This is not there's not a ton of people who live here. There's not a lot of resources. And there could have been low expectations. And I was trying to manage expectations of people coming here. And I was so afraid of the negativity and the criticism. And I told Scott Grooms, who's running the Wildlife Center where the media room was set up. He's a city employee. I told City Manager Jeff Molinari. I've made it tried to have the chance to tell Becky Hill, who the clerk of court. They did such an incredible job of managing all this and meeting and exceeding those expectations. They didn't give people an opportunity to criticize this place in this town because they were prepared. They worked their tails off to make sure it was top notch, top flight, as professional as you could want it, as accommodating as you could want it, for media coverage, for all the people who had to come in here and live and work for 6 weeks and be staked out outside a small little area and in cramped spaces. And it was above and beyond anything anybody could have hoped and dreamed for. They left no room for criticism, left no room for doubt. They did a terrific job and they deserve all the praise. And I couldn't be prouder to brag up a little bit about Walterboro after all this. So shout out to all of you.
Right. Absolutely. And also the wonderful ladies that helped us with our house and our podcast setup.
The Collin County Historical and Preservation Society, Sarah
How
Miller.
Wonderful is that?
She's a professor over at the University of South Carolina Satellite Campus here in Walterboro, longtime friend of mine, helped us out with the house. This set that you're seeing here, that we're doing this podcast every day, it's not just a podcast set. There are bedrooms and there's a living space for our crew that has been here for 6 weeks, living out of this nice house in the historic downtown part of Walterboro.
It just made our life so wonderful.
I agree.
And we're so grateful to the people of Walterboro, and we don't know how to say, there isn't a way that we could thank you enough for what they did for us. Mm-hmm. And I know that the entire press corps feels the same way. And that is one of the largest contingency of press corps outside of a major presidential primary or rally that I've seen anywhere. This absolutely takes the cake. I do want to do one more thing before we go. First of all, I want you to know we have more stories here. We are not done. We have more to unpack. I have a lot of people that you still need to meet in this story. And we will bring you those people in Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdochs. I also want to remind you that if you've enjoyed this, not only to rate and review this podcast so that other people can find it and hear this extraordinary story. Also, we have another one under the Unsolved South Carolina franchise, and that is Finding Brittany Drexel, a compelling story about a young girl who went missing, vanished 13 years ago in Myrtle Beach, and the story of how there was justice for Brittany Drexel. I think we've got it. That's perfect. I think I wrapped it up. But please try and find Finding Brittany Drexel. It's a real passion project of Drew and mine. It's that fantastic music is going to be by Max Harrison. Daniel Michener, who was also the editor on the documentary style podcast of the Murdochs that took us to this place where we could do the daily recap, where we could be able to give you the kind of insight that you deserved on a story like this. That was under the editor, the editor Dan Michener, and he also did Finding Brittany Drexel, and there are more to come. So please stay with us. We have enjoyed every single second we've had with you.
Till next time.
I'll say so.
Yeah.
I'll say so. And I should say, as Mayor Young of Walterboro would say, we'll be heading back to Charleston, which is near Walterboro.
That's right. Charleston.
Not the other way around.
Charleston that's near Walterboro. Charlie, Drew, Max, anyone else that's in this house right now, thank you. Thank you so much. And we will continue our conversation with you very soon. Thanks.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Allow your imagination to be piqued by stories that are brought to life through captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. As an Audible member, you'll be able to keep your heart rate up month after month because you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. If you're in the mood for a shocking psychological thriller, check out None of This Is True by Lisa Jewell. Embrace brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.